Hello and welcome to the Eastern Arc podcast series. My name is Phil Ward and I'm director of Eastern Arc. This is a third in a mini-series of podcasts looking at the American election coming up on the 3rd of November and the campaign that's leading up to it. We've already looked at underlying issues which are going to inform the election, including coronavirus and civil unrest. We've also looked at the history that shaped the current system, the Electoral College and the issues of faith and the emergence of the evangelical right. In this, the third and final part of the mini-series, we're going to look at the strategies that the Democrats and the Republicans are going to use to try and sway the vote. Joining me to discuss these issues are Emma Long, a senior lecturer in American Studies in the School of Art, Media and American Studies at UEA, Royce Carroll, a professor in the School of Government at the University of Essex, and Rubert Began, a lecturer in International Relations in the School of Politics and IR at the University of Kent. I wanted to begin by getting a sense of where we're at and looking at the polling evidence that's available at the moment. I asked Royce to give an overview.
Sure, Phil. So the quantitative bit, I think, is relatively straightforward in that, as everyone has likely become aware, there has been consistent lead in favor of Biden against Trump, and that has been maintained for quite some time. I think that the interesting features of this election are very much hidden by numbers like that, because they are in aspects of polling that are not routinely met and captured. And I think one of the most important bits to keep in mind is how important partisanship is driving this election. It has been steadily increasing as rationale for voting. And my intuition is that it's going very much off the charts at this moment in terms of what's motivating the interest in the election. And that is something that I think is not really systematically measured in the same way that we see the top line measurements about election. It's really crucial because it pertains to the sensitivity that the top line has to various factors that are in some ways unique to the mix of mobilization and persuasion elements that are taking place in this dynamic. So, for instance, I think the bulk of Biden's appeal and strategy mainly to represent a return to a generic notion of pre-Trump normalcy and try to keep that as vaguely defined as possible in order to make that camp as large as possible. But that argument is fundamentally a negative one and built upon the notion that Trump is initially divisive or dangerous or unsuccessful president. Meanwhile, on Trump's side, very much the same logic holds, that there is some great threat that would befall the nation were Biden to become president, not necessarily solely because of Biden himself, taking very much into account that he is amorphous enough that it's actually fairly difficult to pinpoint him as the villain, but nevertheless, the broad notion of the left, liberals, the Democratic Party, and all sorts of groups that are associated with them are being framed as the dangers to the country that Trump is the only force holding back. And that relates very much to issues such as the law and order framing, or so-called law and order framing, that is about suggesting that there is a security decline on the horizon that requires a much stronger federal intervention, and that Trump is necessary to do that. This is actually building very much on a long-term strategy of focusing on threats and trying to amplify them and create the impression that Trump is the only defender against such threats. And the reason why those two things, despite being different in nature, they both have at their core a lack of a candidate putting forth a positive that is specifically appealing to different demographics. So they are fighting very much over what is the most threatening aspect of the winning the election. And given that, I think that means that various aspects of the way people respond to general polling, including now, are particularly hard to pinpoint because turnout relies very heavily on the positive sense, and it can, in some cases, at a certain threshold, be defined by that negative sense. And in between is the very common phenomenon of voter apathy and voter alienation, which is really going to be the decisive factor in the election ultimately. And that really is very difficult to determine precisely, particularly in a context where all those features I just mentioned are at work in the context of significant valence factors working against the incumbent that are sensitive to daily information. They're affecting how much enthusiasm there is for Trump, how much antagonism against, the intensity of each of those things. And if some of those factors change, Biden's strategy could go from being a reasonable conservative approach to being totally mismatched with the environment.
It's difficult to sort of say anything beyond the statement that Biden is a favorite. He's not an overwhelming favorite because, of course, as a lot of commentators have pointed out, Trump does have this advantage in the Electoral College where he can win the presidency, win a second term, despite, you know, receiving 3-4 million fewer votes than Biden.
There's another issue that has been raised that I think is worth mentioning, which is that response biases may have actually changed in the interim as well, not just in 2016, but since 2016, in the willingness of Trump supporters to actually respond accurately to the polls. A study came out the other day that suggested that there was a disproportionate distrust of polling responses from the Trump side, which, if that were true, would be somewhat analogous to the shy voter phenomenon that we have seen in any other cases, but a little different in the sense that they aren't necessarily shy, but actually have in mind that maybe the polling agency is somehow recording what you're doing and using it against you. And that kind of more extreme distrust, I think, also makes it very difficult for polling to run.
So it's difficult to read too much into the polls at the moment. But what's your sense in how the campaigns are currently being run?
And the campaigns have kind of unfolded in the way I think we would have expected going in, you know, if we sort of thought about what they would look like last year, despite the kind of shock of coronavirus. I mean, Biden's campaign strikes me as being very similar to the kind of campaign that Hillary Clinton ran in 2016. The difference, of course, is this time Trump is the incumbent. He's got a record he has to defend. But of course, the Democrats are trying to make it a referendum on Trump himself. I think there's some interesting differences with Trump's campaign this time around as compared to 2016. And it strikes me as populist, but not populist in the same way. And so, as I said, I don't have, you know, research interest in American domestic politics. I do kind of follow populism in the way that populism plays out and has played out with Trump's foreign policy. And I think Trump is still campaigning in this kind of populist mode via the kind of law and order framing, you know, which can be traced back to Nixon. And scholars of the American presidency sort of see Nixon as a populist turn in American presidential politics on the right, in some respects. So I think the law and order stuff is, there is a kind of populist edge there. But the populism that Trump campaigned on in 2016 had a more kind of an economic dimension to it. So it was sort of cast as being in opposition to globalism and economic globalization and free trade. He spent quite a bit of time in 2016 talking about trade. It doesn't really show up as much in this cycle. So I think that's been interesting, the kind of mutation of the way in which populism kind of plays into Trump's political strategy. I think there's, you know, that's something that's probably understudied or underappreciated at the moment.
One of the fundamental tools for Trump's populism is his use of social media and Twitter in particular. How does his social media strategy compare to that of Biden and Harris?
Well, I mean, when it comes to Trump, he's very skillful at manipulating the media to draw attention to himself. And that's obviously something that's been a hallmark of his career going back before he entered politics. So, you know, his ability to kind of manipulate tabloids in New York City, his skill in terms of, you know, having a television presence, and then now it's kind of transferred onto social media. You know, you sort of hear this notion that he can change the conversation, this national media conversation, by tweeting something to sort of shift the focus of what people are paying attention to. I don't know how much of that is strategic or if it's just kind of sort of defensive reaction on his part. But certainly there's something interesting about Twitter in that it allows him to speak directly to an unmediated group of people, right? So he can sort of connect with his followers directly without kind of worrying about a media filter. You don't see anything even remotely comparable from the Biden-Harris campaign, as far as I'm aware of it, being able to use social media in that way. But at the same time, it sort of detracts from Trump's ability to appeal to more moderate, independent voters, because, you know, something that kind of comes up quite a bit is that people don't like his tweeting, right? There's probably even a bit of polling evidence on this that suggests that people think he should tweet less. So just we're sort of back to this tension between Trump stoking his base versus, trying to do something else to sort of win voters in the middle.
We've all become exhausted, maybe, by the constant tweeting and the reports of the latest tweet to come from Trump or from the White House. I don't know, but I do wonder how much of an impact that might have, whether, you know, those who like it may be paying more attention and those who don't may be switching off.
Trump use of social media, of course, is unprecedented. That unmediated relationship that Rubik just mentioned is part of where he is able to develop a sense of personal connection to his base, in which they do see him very much as different, in part because of how casual he is in his observations. And as Rubik says, every effort made in that direction obviously detracts from the gravitas of the office and of having a polished image. And that does harm his ability to persuade. I think it feeds into some of the reason why some of his options are perhaps closed off. I mean, we can say that he could have turned into a persuasion campaign in the middle of this year, but on the other hand, he did spend 3 years really, really driving the point home that he was representing his base first and foremost. And there is a lot of resistance, and he has already lost potentially persuadable voters in part because of his style and that element of things. So I think that this all is just one of the pieces of that overall strategy, which is to make sure that the base is as large as possible, the group he's willing to be limited to. Meanwhile, on the Democrat side, I think have something that is almost completely the opposite. There is definitely not a natural flair for social media in the Biden campaign. Part of the reason why that is not going to be experimented with is because they are indeed focused on persuasion. They are trying to have a very, very broad, generically anti-Trump coalition that includes people spanning vast ideological spectrum, which includes disaffected Republicans and quite committed leftists in the same group. So how many tweets can you make that are of any substance that don't in some way reduce the size of that coalition? I think that is a big part of why their social media approach is as boring as it is. And that's why I think Joe Biden's Twitter feed more or less looks as though it was generated by a computer, because it is just a series of apparently quite focus group lines about how it would be better if a different person were president. And that's essentially the gist of of his communication strategy.
Trump is still very much at the center of the campaign itself. So he's the big issue, as it were. We have these other issues, coronavirus, the economy, the recession, race relations. But to me, it sort of all kind of pivots around Trump himself.
He's already started to frame Joe Biden as slow Joe and has been very keen to get under the banner of law and order and being the person who can restore order. And yet he's the incumbent. Do you think he's going to essentially be able to distance himself from his record to a certain extent if it's convenient for him and throw that onto the Democrats? He's already talking about the mayors of Kenosha and other places being responsible rather than him being responsible for these riots and this disorder. Do you get a sense that that strategy will work for him?
Probably not. I don't think so. I mean, I think that's why he's behind. I mean, he needs something to kind of shift or something to change within the dynamics of the race to sort of pull a bit closer to Biden and then have a shot But it's done enough for him to keep his base. So this is sort of constant theme with the Trump presidency, that he seems sort of overwhelmingly concerned about taking care of those who already strongly support him. He's very good at that, at talking to his base and sort of solidifying his base, the sort of, you know, 30% of the country that really kind of enthusiastically supports him. And then there's a bit more that will, you know, vote for partisan reasons. But he's certainly having more trouble, I think, this time around than he did last time with sort of speaking to swing voters. So some of the polling data suggests that voters who dislike both candidates now favor Biden this time around, whereas voters who dislike both candidates 2016 lean toward Trump. And there's just too much going on. I mean, I think, you know, with coronavirus, with this recession, I mean, had that stuff not happened, then maybe it would be enough for him to sort of try to shift the buck and put more attention on Democrats, you know, given the kind of negative partisanship and polarization that characterizes American politics at the moment. But my sense is that he would have to do a bit more. And I don't know what that would look like for him strategically. But I think that helps to explain why he's the underdog, despite being, you know, the incumbent. I mean, he should be in a relatively good position this time around with the support of the Republican Party, and he's not. So, I mean, we're looking to kind of explain his position. I think that the fact that he's just sort of throwing everything out, trying to turn it back on Democrats is probably more of a problem for him.
There is a portion of Republicans, enthusiastic Romney supporters, for instance, and actually thought that set of ideas was a good path forward and stuck with the party, but are definitely potentially alienated by a lot of this based focused strategizing. Are they permanently alienated, or do they return home when things get serious? And in particular, do they do that if he is able to drive up their own negative partisanship, meaning to sort of recruit them into the group of people who are dedicated to using Trump essentially as the only game in town to prevent the victory of some force that they would be concerned about? So his angle is, I think, less about trying to balance that persuasion with that mobilization as much as trying to figure out ways to expand the base and incorporate previously softer Trump supporters into the mobilized group, as well as previously alienated supporters. And that's an important offsetting fact. There are still people who didn't vote in 2018. If he is able to find them and turn them into voters, that's something that I think we would not be able to see very clearly right now in most of our data. So his advisors must believe that there is a pathway to victory without as much focus on persuasion. Not to say he's not doing any, but I think, as Rubik was saying, in all the opportunities where it was, if you really wanted to focus on persuasion, he hasn't taken those opportunities the way you would think.
We talked in the previous episode about the evangelicals and the difference they've made to the American political scene. I asked Emma about the place of the evangelicals within Trump's base and their potential for being won over to the Democrats.
There was a poll back in August, I think, which suggested that 81% of evangelicals would vote for Trump in November, which sort of on one hand suggests that actually, for all the criticism that's come, whether over the economy or coronavirus or other policies, that actually the 4 years of the Trump administration has made no impact. But that said, Biden and Kamala Harris are both, in many ways, are both more naturally inclined to speak about their own faith than Hillary Clinton was. Mm. Biden has a long history of speaking about his how his Catholic faith has been important to him and has got him through difficult moments. And Kamala Harris has spoken about that too. And both of them do it in a kind of much more naturalistic way than when Clinton did that, where it felt a bit more forced, where it was sort of kind of, you know, advisors had told her she needed to do this to speak to the electorate, whereas her more natural tendency was that her faith was private and not for public discussion. So there is scope, I think, for them to appeal to some of those evangelicals who have become disaffected as a result of the experience of the Trump administration rather than the kind of the promise of it in 2016. there are some within the evangelical movement who are very much that never a Democrat. You can vote for anybody, but not Democrats. So some will write in, some will find third party candidates, some just may not vote at all. I mean, that's the big question, right, over the current election, with issues about mail-in voting and how safe it is to go out to vote, how many people will just stay home, and whether that will have a bigger impact for one party or another.
That issue of turnout is a serious one. There's been accusations in the news recently about postal votes being misdirected, or the implication that they're not going to be counted. There's also accusations around polling places being closed in certain districts so that their votes aren't counted. Is this a real issue? And if so, what effect will it have?
As far as the actual interference, well, he definitely has tried to diminish the Postal Service's capacity precisely at the time in which these postal votes would be important. That much is true. Whether or not that really impacts real voting outcomes, I think, is another story. But I think in my own view, I think his attempt to undermine the legitimacy of the process is the bigger point there. And it is relevant both in the context of how he's mobilizing the base, which is to try to give the impression that there is such a potentially fraudulent force coming against them that they have to mobilize even more militantly in favor of Trump. And that's an important part of his strategy, to make sure that hardcore portion is as utterly motivated as they possibly could be. So that, I think, is going to have an important effect.
As a representative of the Republican Party, a lot of people have fallen in line with his argument, which is to say that mail-in votes are a threat because they can be tampered with or undermined. And I mean, the other issues you mentioned, the closing of polling places and the making of it more difficult to vote. I mean, there's a much longer history of that, thinking back before Trump, with issues about needing forms of ID to be able to vote, and the kind of forms of ID that a lot of people who fall into the lower socioeconomic classes perhaps don't have. And so the possibility of them being disenfranchised. And you know, so there's a long, long background to that, that this is part of.
I finished by asking each of our participants what they thought the outcome of the election would be. Who's going to take it?
Well, I mean, I thought Clinton would win in 2016. So with that caveat out there, I think Biden will win, probably by 6 or 7 points. But I certainly wouldn't be as surprised this time around if Trump wins a second term as I was in 2016.
Royce?
I think Biden, if he's maintaining the lead that he has now, he will win by a smaller margin. That would be my guess. I am not convinced that he can hold that lead because he hasn't really yet campaigned. So it's difficult to extrapolate from anything that has happened so far as to whether or not the deal closure actually comes up in the next 2 months that is needed to keep that in line. But I would caution Dresch that his lead on the polls needs to remain quite high in order for him to have confidence that the Electoral College is actually going to sway. And that is a major, major issue. And if you factor that in, we're talking about something that is actually close.
Oh, I got this wrong in 2016. So the likelihood is that I'm going to get it wrong again. I mean, as things currently stand, it wouldn't be a surprise to me if either, you know, if the result goes either way. Given the way that we saw 2016 go, my head says that Trump probably has the slight advantage here, both in terms of incumbency and the fact that while his approval rates have been low, you know, historically low in some cases, they have been consistent, which suggests that there's a group of people who, no matter what he has done, remain supportive. And so then the question becomes those few floating voters in the middle. My heart would prefer that the result goes the other way and that Biden is successful. I find myself quite legitimately torn between what I would like to see and what I think we might Yes, we'll see. And probably not the day after the election either. I was just reading about postal votes this morning, and the deadlines that some states have for the returning of postal votes are actually quite a long way after the election date. So there is a possibility we're going to be waiting a while.
It might be a long wait, but Americans, together with the wider global community, will be waiting with excitement and trepidation for the results after the 3rd of November. But for the meantime, I'd like to thank all three of my guests, Emma Long of UEA, Royce Carroll of Essex, and Rubric Began from the University of Kent, and to all of those who helped put together this podcast, including Jeff Harvey and Chris Martin, who did the music. And to you for tuning in to this mini-series on the American election. I hope you can join me next time when we will continue our exploration to the furthest reaches of Eastern Arc.